mistake.
So I appreciate the invitation, and I thoroughly enjoyed the workshop a couple of weeks ago. I feel like I've been a bear in hibernation for 3 or 4 years while I've been building up experiments, either as a postdoc at Caltech, experiments which have finally worked now that I've left them alone, and now setting up labs at UC Berkeley. So we're finally on the scene, and it was a good chance to catch up and see that the field is thriving and that we have a lot to do with our machines now that they're working. So let me fill you in about our ideas, what we're planning to do. I'll show you a little bit of data on one of our experiments. I've got an obscene amount of material, so please interrupt and prevent me from showing all of it. And just tell me when to stop, and I'll stop.
Do you want to tell us just where you are in the experiment?
All things will become clear. I'll get to it in a sec. We have a rubidium BEC experiment. We're one of several dozen. And what I've enjoyed the most in the field has been the most condensed matter of topics. And my view on the field is that we're going to have a lot to say about condensed matter physics, even though we're going to be working with systems which are at ridiculous densities. And it simply has to do with the fact that while we may not be exploring materials and explaining their properties, we're rather engaged in condensed matter as the exploration of the entire space of many body quantum mechanics models. And if you happen to set those up in a gas or set them up in a solid, you get to ask the same questions and get interesting answers. So atomic physicists have somewhat have a new set of tools for manipulating the systems that we've created and for probing them, and that should allow us to both explore things which are analogous to existing condensed matter systems, but also to put together models of many-body quantum systems which are different than what had been set up in solid state or dense liquids. And so here's a listing of a few of them, the ones that I'm interested in for my research. Obviously, this is a tremendously interesting topic, which is just started to have been touched, and a lot of the theory work done in this room is pointing to a very rich harvest if we can set up a lot of experiments with relation to models of magnetism and such. So I think there's a lot to reap there. Spinner Bose-Einstein condensates, these are condensates where the spin degree of freedom of the atoms is liberated and is allowed to play a role. And there's a lot that we're hoping to explore there. So we're now setting up experiments to optically trap condensates, which is a precursor to this work, and then a combination of an optical imaging technique, which should allow us to see the spinner condensates in situ, and then a variety of other tools to manipulate them. We've also been working out ideas for something which I'll describe in a second, something called the periodically dressed Bose-Einstein condensate. This is a condensate which is made anisotropic by being placed in a very anisotropic type of medium. We're thinking of setting up a new experiment. I suppose this is somewhat dependent on how my tenure case goes and whether I really want to set up another experiment at Berkeley. But if we did, we'd be interested in making ultra-cold molecules by Feshbach Association and trying to introduce ideas of quantum fluids into chemistry. And, of course, there's a lot more to do. So it still did seem worthwhile to make yet another BEC machine, although new experimentalists now joining the fray, I feel like I'm the last one on the island, and I'm telling everybody not to join in, that unfortunately, it's a very big investment for an experimentalist still to build one of these machines. And one should wonder whether everybody who has an experimental idea really needs to build their own apparatus, or whether maybe we can just travel to each other's labs and carry out ideas there and be a little more efficient. But not what I did. So here's what I'll tell you about. I'll start off with a description of this theoretical work, which we're hoping to implement in the laboratory. I'll tell you about our first experiment, which is on a different topic, which is nonlinear optics. And I'll explain why we think that's pretty interesting. And if there was time, I would tell you about what's going on in a second laboratory in my group. So this work would all be implemented on the rubidium Bose condensate that we have in our lab. On another machine, we're trying to place cold rubidium atoms, perhaps condensates, into high-finesse optical cavities where we achieve strong coupling for single atoms and single photons. So if there's time at the end, I'll tell you about what we're thinking about with regard to that. So let's start with this idea of periodically dressed condensates, and let me start with the idea of dress states. Let's start with atoms which have two internal states, and these states are simply coupled by some external drive. So we can think about Rabi oscillations in such a system, but there's a different view of it, which is handy, which maybe relies a little bit on quantum optics, although it can also be described without resorting to the quantization of photons. But anyhow, one regards the system as not being just the atom itself, but the atom plus the photons, let's say, which are the driving field. And when you think about it in that manner, you find that there are a set of manifolds where you have two closely spaced levels, levels which are almost the same in energy, because taking one photon out of the drive and exciting the atom is kind of an even trade of energy. In that case, the driven system becomes regarded as a static system, and we can just think about static quantum mechanics instead of the time-dependent picture. The eigenstates in such a situation, of course, would just be superpositions of the dressed B and the dressed A atom, and they would be split by something related to the strength of the coupling. And these dressed states can be seen in experiments as follows. Let's imagine you do an experiment where you start off with all of your atoms in state A, and I'll represent the amount, the probability of being in state A by the shade of this circle. And then as a function of time, starting with no coupling, you either suddenly switch on a coupling field or you gradually switch on a coupling field. This you could do in any kind of two-level resonance experiment that you're interested in. If you do things gradually, what you find is that your atoms end up starting their life in one of the dressed states, but it's a state that's not at all a superposition with the other level because there's no coupling. And now as you slowly ramp up the strength of the drive, you would end up mapping that state, which is all A, into a state which is a superposition of A and B, perhaps an even superposition if you're right on resonance. In contrast, if you suddenly switch on the strength of the drive, you project your system suddenly into a superposition of different dress states. And one has the image of the reason why there's Rabi oscillations is simply the beating of those two states because they have different energies. So in that case of this sudden projection, you would see your Rabi oscillations where your atom oscillates between A and B and back and forth. And this would be a signal that's visible to you in your experiment, say by taking a bunch of images of clouds. Whereas if you gradually ramp up the strength of the drive and you remain adiabatically in the dress state, then you've mapped yourself into a state where there is no, this is certainly a state which is evolving dynamically because it's a driven system, but at least in terms of populations in the two levels, you don't see any dynamics. So condensates which are dressed have been explored, and these experiments and then theoretical work all done at Jill kind of got us thinking about this. And so maybe I'll just review what some of those experiments were about.
So, in the real experiments, is it Raman coupling or the real coupling
In what we're thinking about, it's going to be a Raman coupling between the two levels.
Maybe between two ground states. So
yes.
You don't worry about spontaneous emission.
I'm not worried about spontaneous emission right now.
So the two states in question, the maximally stretched states?
Not necessarily. Any two states will do. Although collisions might disturb you. Okay. So here's an experiment that was done in Eric Cornell's group. They did the following. They have a two-level system, red atoms, blue atoms. And they started with a condensate which was entirely red. They then turned on a coupling field. But somewhat non-trivially, they made a coupling field whose strength, because of a change of detuning across the cloud, whose strength was not isotropic. And so as a function of time, the superfluid, which oscillated from the red to the blue state and back and forth, started actually picking up perhaps a set of striations where maybe over here the system evolved for, six pi rotations, but here it evolved for 7 pi, and so it ended up in the blue state, and here it was 8 pi, and ended up back in the red state. And so you could, in this manner, by having a spatially dependent coupling, end up basically winding up some kind of periodic pattern inside the Bose-Einstein condensate. And you might ask, if I keep this going, what do I end up seeing? And if these atoms were pinned down and stationary, you would simply regard this as a certain example of inhomogeneous broadening in the sense of resonance. And that after a while, these striations would get so fine that they would become irrelevant, and you would just see a wash. What they saw instead was that dynamically the system periodically returned to the all red state, that the superfluid here had a way of winding itself up, a phase between the components, and then unwinding itself. And this just recurred periodically, which was a very confusing thing to think about until we started examining this a little bit with some back of the envelope calculations and thought about it rather than in the frame of red and blue states, thinking about it in the frame of the dress states of the system. Now we have a different picture. We imagine we have a condensate which is suddenly projected into a superposition of dress states. So it's a two-component condensate, and there's no coupling between the two. Now they're just dress states, and they move around. But they move around in different potentials. That's the meaning of the inhomogeneous coupling between the two levels. Now it's not so hard to think about a superfluid which has two components, which lives in traps that are slightly offset from each other, that there would be some kind of excitation mode, and that this would have some periodicity. And this would exactly explain the periodic recurrences that were seen in the Eric-Cornell experiment. So inspired by that, we started to think of other ways in which you might vary, spatially vary the type of coupling between two internal states of an atom and ultimately of a superfluid. And this is where we've thought of the scheme of Raman coupling. So now we imagine we have these, again, a two-level atom, and we illuminate it simultaneously with two laser beams, which, with this kind of atomic scheme, affect a Raman transition between the two levels. The beams are not collinear, and so the Raman transition imparts a momentum to the atom. And so, as such, an atom in state A with original momentum Q would absorb a photon, emit a photon, and end up in state B, but with a different momentum, Q plus K, K being the difference between the momenta of the two light beams. One might regard this, and I'll try to convince you that this is the case, one might regard that what a way of describing this kind of coupling is by describing the coupling between two levels as being a periodic function of position. So this is a periodic potential. So we may be able to use some of the ideas of just particles in a periodic potential. But it's a slightly unusual periodic potential. It's still, at this level, it's one-dimensional physics, but we've placed the periodicity and the potential not in the diagonal elements, but in the off-diagonal elements of a Hamiltonian. And I'll show you in a sec that means that you don't end up with band structure. You end up with something different than band structure. But of course, there are some relations between the two ideas. Now, what's the dispersion relation of a gas exposed to this kind of light, or living in this kind of periodic medium? We think of it in the following sense. An atom of state A with momentum Q minus K over 2, surrounded by these laser beams, is almost the same in energy as this state above here, where an atom has absorbed one photon, although there might be a large detuning from the excited state resonance, so we'll eventually eliminate that from the problem. There's a third state which is possible, which is where there's finally been an exchange of photons, and the atom has picked up the recoil momenta of the photons. So the way we're going to describe this is in terms of momentum of the system. We can really regard these two states, if I include the photons, these two states are states of identical momentum. So I'm justified in plotting them as in terms of energy versus some well-defined momentum. Even though the atoms in the two levels have a different momentum, the total system is a momentum eigenstate. In the absence of coupling, the way I would describe this is simply to say that atoms of type, I think I've confused the colors, atoms of type A have a parabolic dispersion relation. Atoms of type B have a parabolic dispersion relation. In the dress state, picture, there's an energy difference between them which is related to the detuning from resonance. And so that causes a shift of the two parabolae, one off of the other. The parabolae are offset from zero because I want to be able to couple, let's say, atoms of type A which are stationary with atoms of type B that are moving, as in this picture. Okay, that's just energetics, and now we add the Rabi frequency. And so you end up with a coupling between these two levels. So the dispersion relation is converted from two parabolae to now being two dispersion curves, one on the bottom, one on the top. Not quite band structure, but still you see why there are similarities. And now you can ask yourself, what does a gas with this kind of dispersion relation do? So that's what we asked ourselves. One thing that's nice about it is that we have experimental parameters by which we can tune the free particle dispersion relation and ask quantum fluids questions about these types of effective particles. Very similar to what you would do when you put electrons in a periodic medium or atoms in lattices of light, where you talk about now effective properties of particles in that system. So for example, just focusing on the detuning, you can go from a situation where there's a well-defined ground state down here and pretty much just a parabolic dispersion relation around it. As you tune closer to resonance, your dispersion relation starts picking up a little bit of a kink out here at the momentum corresponding to the momentum transfer. And you might, if you stare at this without your glasses on, you might see some similarities eventually between this and let's say the Roton minimum in helium. It was just a question of energetics. I'll get to that point later. If you tune yourself right to resonance, you get a very interesting problem where you now have a system which has degenerate states in momentum space and has to decide in which state to condense. And then finally, by switching the detuning from one side to the other, you can send the ground state from being atoms of one type to atoms of another type. And there are other ways to tune the system, be it the frequency of the light, the angle between the laser beams, which changes the recoil energy, the strength of the coupling, etc. And this is all tunable in real time. Okay, so let's ask what happens if I try to condense bosons with this kind of dispersion relation. Well, obviously the condensate is going to form in the lowest energy state, given that there's not some other conservation rule which would prevent it from doing so. So for example, in one case I can have the condensate form down in this well, which would be a condensate which is mostly atoms of type A at rest and a little bit of a mixture of atoms of type B that are moving. Or I can switch the detuning to get the opposite ground state. Fine, that's not so complicated. Next, we added interactions. We considered interactions where the interaction between particles is non-magnetic. Maybe think that the scattering length for any type of collision, be it the same particles colliding or the cross scattering length, that they're all identical, so don't have to worry about asymmetries brought about by that. Anyhow, we churn through that. We just look up Bogoliubov and add a little bit of complication. And one ends up, as one expects, with a quasi-particle spectrum. And one simply gets it by diagonalizing a 4x4 matrix, which is relevant to the problem. The excitations now, let's say this is the quasi-particle with momentum Q with respect to the condensate momentum. So it's composed of excitation of particles in the lower dispersion relation, which is labeled by mu, maybe creation or also excitations of either holes or particles in the minus Q momentum with respect to the condensate, etc. So in general, the quasi-particles are going to be mixtures of excitations forwards and backwards, as you typically get for the Bogoliubov excitations, but also excitations both in the lower dispersion curve and the upper dispersion curve. The condensate would then be defined by the fact that it's the vacuum with respect to all of those operators. And so now we have defined the interacting condensate as well.
Can you add an excel potential that transponder and make it somewhere between implemented states?
Yes. So I'll get to that. Okay. Yeah. So this is all a homogeneous system at this stage. So this is the kind of dispersion relation we get for the condensate, and I want to make the point here that it's typical, it's atypical, and it's anisotropic all at the same time. We're looking here at a bunch of curves. These dashed lines are the free particle or the dress state, the bare dress state particles, in the absence of a condensate and in the absence of interaction, and that's just their energy. And in black here is the Bogubov quasi-particles for this dress state system. And you see they do sort of what you think they should. Down at low momentum, you end up with linear dispersion relations, so you have a defined speed of sound. The speed of sound may be modified because you have an effective mass rather than the bare mass, but that's not a large complication. The dispersion relation, at least in the longitudinal direction, has, again, can acquire this little dip, and one can imagine now that that's going to influence superfluidity in such a system. And there's also kind of a connection with the dispersion relation of a bare Bose condensate, because because you can see that there should be, as you reduce the strength of the Raman coupling, you should just drop onto that dispersion relation on its own. And the anisotropy is also marked by the fact that the dispersion relation in the longitudinal direction is quite different from those in the transverse directions. That is, the anisotropy is just along one direction as we've defined it here. Looking at that again, this is just a similar curve, but here what we've varied is the strength of the Raman coupling. And this is just to make the point that if what you're after is this little dip, then you have to tune the Raman coupling to be not excessively large. When it's excessively large, the dispersion relation pushes the lower and upper branches so far apart from each other that you end up losing that dip. So that'll be important in later slides. What I wanted to emphasize with this slide was, again, the aspect of tunability that one has in the system. So we're imagining implementing this with particles of rubidium-87, and if you just use a two-photon process to do so, which may have some trouble associated with it, but anyhow, if you just use a two-photon transition, you get recoil energies in this range, and compared to the chemical potential, you see you can tune your recoil energy to be above or below the chemical potential. So that's pretty handy. The Rabi frequency and the detuning can be tuned basically arbitrarily. There's roughly no limit to what one can provide with lasers these days. The one caveat is that you increase the Rabi frequency by increasing the intensity, and that will increase the scattering rate since the excited state does still exist in the system. And you'd have to think a little bit about which states you're trying to connect and whether you can actually favorably connect them even at large detuning. Anyhow, that's just a little bit of atomic physics to keep in mind. So one would expect this anisotropic dispersion relation to influence superfluidity. So if I think about the Landau criterion for superfluidity, then all I have to do is stare at the dispersion relation, and the superfluid velocity is always defined by the slope of the line which just strikes the dispersion relation when starting from zero. So for example, in liquid helium, where you have phonons at low momentum and then a roton dip further up, then the Landau critical velocity would be determined by the position of that roton minimum. This was hard to see in liquid helium because to see this, you have to really bump your superfluid against microscopic impurities rather than macroscopic impurities. But nevertheless, it was done, and the results, I guess, were decently in agreement with what one would have expected. In the regular dilute BECs where that roton minimum is absent, then the critical velocity is defined by the speed of sound. That's the part of the dispersion relation which is relevant. And this was measured in a number of ways. I'll talk about this one in particular, a way in which you can measure the superfluid velocity by scattering a gas of impurities through the system, which is probably the way we would try to measure it with this setup right here. And now that we have this anisotropic dispersion relation, we now should expect you applying this Landau criterion should give you different results for the critical velocity for flow in different directions through the superfluid. So flowing in one direction, you'd be limited by this little dip in the dispersion relation, the sort of artificial roton. It's not a statement about the type of excitation, just about its energy. And this might be at a lower velocity than you would encounter in the opposite direction. So the anisotropy of the effective particles in this periodic medium leads to an anisotropy in the superfluid velocity. So here would be a calculation for what would happen as you vary the detuning, where on one side you get basically just superfluidity limited by the speed of sound. The speed of sound is dropping here a little bit because you're adding some effective mass to your system. Whereas in the other direction, you at some point build in this little Roton minimum, and your superfluid velocity would drop rapidly to zero. So you'd have a one-way superfluid in the sense that passing this superfluid forward past a bunch of impurities would lead to no viscosity, but it would get stuck on its return. Okay. And the way I would propose to measure this, and indeed we've been talking on a number of topics in the last couple of days on how we want to apply this, is with this method of...
Would that give some kind of ratchet?
If you were wiggling your system back and forth?
Yeah. Is it a quantum ratchet or something like that?
I don't know, it's a dissipative ratchet, so I don't know if you'd want to use it.
Okay. Is it very different from the behavior you'd expect for ions and helium, if the helium were actually flowing? So the same ring.
If the helium were flowing, yeah, then you would define it with respect to the velocity of the helium. But it is quite different. Yeah, well, it's, in that sense, it's not different, but it is different in the sense that this... that there's not a relation between this critical velocity and the velocity of flow, which you might be thinking of with respect to, you know, the k vector of the Raman beams.
There's no relation.
I don't think that's of relevance here. Okay, so the method of measuring superfluidity by means of impurity scattering is as follows. This is how it was implemented in one of the last experiments I did in Wolfgang Ketterle's group. Something like this. We had a Bose condensate in a particular magnetic sublevel, and using laser beams, which affected a Raman transition, we excited a bunch of atoms to a different spin state. And our understanding was to regard these atoms as microscopic impurities, which are imageable and are distinct from the condensate. This other type of gas then flows, and it flows, for example, by leaving the condensate. And what will be the signature of superfluidity, that is, dissipationless flow versus flow with dissipation and viscosity? It simply is the presence or absence of elastic scattering. So some particles may leave the superfluid without any scattering, and just travel along in their merry way upwards. But other ones may collide. This is, after all, two bits of gas that are flying past each other. So some fraction of the atoms will collide and scatter off to different momenta. When we then examine this system in time of flight, one can distinguish atoms of one type from the other. That's really not difficult. And within, let's say, the impurity atoms, one can identify both in momentum space the fraction of atoms that underwent no collisions, and then a fraction of atoms that did undergo collisions. And so to understand whether there is or is not a viscosity, what I'd rather consider is what is the cross-section for one type of gas passing through a different type of gas. If the atoms are moving very fast and superfluidity is not an issue because we're well above the critical velocity, we should just recover a standard result for the cross-section. If we now slow down the impurities to where they're moving below the critical velocity, the cross-section at that velocity should drop to zero. And one can measure that just by measuring the fraction of atoms that have collided. So I think this would be a pretty clean way, since we have all sorts of spin states available to us, to do this kind of experiment with our periodically dressed gas. So to address this very problem, we did a little bit of numerics to understand what signature we would see in this cross-section, which one might measure in such an experiment. And what bothered us and made us want to do this calculation is the following. To some extent, if you look at this dispersion relation, the depression of the critical velocity in this direction does not seem to have anything to do really with the strength of the Raman coupling. That is, the dispersion relation reaches down here whether or not there's a strong Raman coupling. And so what gives? We have a system which in the absence of Raman coupling should look like a regular BEC and have a critical velocity which is non-zero, and yet you add an infinitesimal Raman coupling between the two states, and now you have this dispersion relation dipping down and suppressing your critical velocity. So how do we understand the crossover from a regular condensate without coupling to the periodically dressed condensate, which has a different critical velocity?
Well, it's not quite infinitely small. We have to beat the original curvature. So there's no Raman coupling. We have this curvature, and
So, I mean, you can imagine basically, you know, this, right?
Yeah.
Then regardless of, I mean, if this is just a small coupling between the two, it would still be true that strictly the critical velocity is quite low. And it could be roughly zero if I have these things pretty close to degenerate. So that just bothered me. I'll show you that it's nothing to be bothered about, but it bothered me. So we went through a calculation to see how things would evolve. I mean, the point is that at weak coupling, this state is sort of irrelevant. Even though it's there, it's not something you touch. So anyhow, it goes through some numerics understanding, you know, let's say we consider a scatterer which collides sort of non-magnetically, that it has identical interactions, and there's no inelastic collisions possible with this impurity. One finds that the scattering cross-section would be influenced by two things, just like it is in the regular, well, by two things. One is it's influenced by energetics, so you have to be able to have, you need a state in which you can scatter. That's this whole discussion about the Landau criterion for superfluidity. You also have another factor, which is the amount of relevant density fluctuations that are in that particular mode that you're trying to scatter into. And that's where the clean crossover from the regular BEC to a periodically dressed BEC is restored. And anyhow, just to get to the punch, one ends up with the following curves when one calculates, again, the normalized scattering rate, which for very large velocities of impurity should reach 1, has the following behavior. So for a scalar BEC that is connected to the experiments which were already done, one sees this dot dashed curve. So one sees no scattering below a critical velocity, and then you get the critical velocity. The scattering rate doesn't instantly rise up to 1, because here you're starting to create phonons by your scattering. Phonons are phase modulations, not density modulations. And so these aren't what's going to lead to scattering. And then as you move up and you start colliding with things that look more and more like free particles, then your regular scattering strength is restored. Now in the periodically dressed condensate, one starts again with this curve, and then with weak coupling, these are the long dashed lines, It is true that you strictly no longer have a critical velocity here, you have a critical velocity here, but the amount of scattering can be quite weak. Simply that if you're scattering atoms out of a condensate and not changing their internal state character, you're not going to overlap with this state very well unless it's strongly coupled. So you get a gradual evolution from a single component BEC to this periodically dressed BEC, and this becomes sort of more and more striking as the strength of the coupling goes up. And the reason why there's all this wiggliness in the response is because you strike the bottom of one dispersion relation and then you strike the bottom of another dispersion relation. So this would be a pretty appealing experimental signature to look for, and within a range of parameters that are entirely reasonable. The last topic we approached with this was, I think, the most interesting, which was this particular situation where you can present your condensate with a degeneracy in momentum space. So if you tune your Raman lasers exactly to resonance, in the dressed state basis, there is no difference between these two different possibilities. And so your atoms, both condensing in an infinite container, what are they going to do? Are they going to break a symmetry and all make a choice to lie in one of the levels? Are they going to occupy both levels simultaneously? What gives? That's not a question we have to ask in a vacuum, because this situation here where I have sort of a double weld dispersion relation in momentum space is dual to the case of which has been considered extensively in the literature, of a double well potential in momentum space. Okay, so let's think about the double well momentum space with regard to bosons. The easiest way to understand it is just using a two-mode approximation where you think of the two lowest single particle levels and don't consider all the other ones that are higher. That certainly complicates the analysis. But you get, as you know quite well, you get a Hamiltonian which has both a hopping strength and an interaction strength. And by varying the ratios and the signs of these various quantities, you can cause different kinds of physics to ensue. So in that double well potential in position space, you have sort of three extremes of solution. If you have no interactions, then your atoms just sit in the single particle ground state, which is the symmetric sum of being on the right and left. If you have strong interactions, though, your system acquires a correlated many-body ground state. In the case of repulsive interactions, which is the situation in condensates which are stable, such as rubidium-87, the preferred state is the half-half state, where an even number of bosons, or the same number of bosons, would reside in the right and in the left wells, and that would minimize the interaction energy, which is all important here. If you had attractive interactions, which are hard to deal with because these would correspond to condensates which are unstable to collapse, you would have quite a spectacular ground state, which would be a Schrodinger cat state, where your atoms have collectively all made the decision to either reside on the left or the right well, but not in both.
Splitting, as it were, would be exponentially smaller in N.
Okay. Yes.
So
yeah.
Very delicate.
Right, right. But certainly there's a smooth behavior, and one can hope to see some aspects of this, but maybe the pure Schrodinger cat state is not worth pursuing. And it's highly susceptible. I mean, one particle falls out of the well and tells you where it is, the gig is up. The situation in momentum space is quite analogous, but the roles of attractive and repulsive interactions are reversed. So basically, if you have a system, now we have a double well in momentum space. If we had condensates with repulsive interactions in position space, that corresponds actually to attractive interactions in momentum space. And therefore, for the condensates that we like making, things like rubidium and sodium, this would be the ground state in our periodically dressed potential.
So that's analogous to the statement if I take helium, let's think about a superconductor since it's simple. I take a superconductor in half a flux quantum of external flux. It will, generally speaking, choose to either choose
yes.
plus current or minus current.
Yeah, yeah. And the reasoning is sort of the same, right? So
yeah.
In both cases, I think, but you're much more an expert on superconductors than I, in both cases it's a question of exchange. It's exchange terms, either exchange forces due to fermions, or here it would be a condensate in a single box where two momentum states are not so different in energy, and yet the system really prefers to live in one momentum state, whatever it is. You think of it because of exchange terms, right? That to simultaneously occupy more than one momentum state would really cost you a lot of energy.
Yes.
Now here in this double well potential, there is an exchange term, and it's tunable. So the particles over here are, let's say, B at rest, and a little bit of A moving. The particles here are A at rest and a little bit of B moving. So the fact that there's a lot of B stationary and a little bit of B moving costs you energy by the exchange term. And so by dialing up the strength of the coupling, you tune up or tune down that exchange term, and that leads to a condensate which will or will not simultaneously inhabit different momentum states.
But isn't it true that it depends on the interaction between the A states and the B states? I mean, you can get all regimes.
Yes, so right, so we need to compare two quantities. We need interactions and tunneling. Okay, so I haven't shown tunneling, but that's what the position space well is about. To match this dual case of a position space double well, we need not just a double well, but we also need something that will not conserve momentum, a reason why momentum would not be conserved. So that is, we need something that looks like kinetic energy with respect to momentum. That is, we need a position space harmonic trapping field. And then the connection between the two is established. And it's pretty handy because the coupling strength is tuned by the strength of your trap. And so that is also it's a pretty easily dialable parameter. If you work out the single particle physics but do it in momentum space, you get a term down here where there will be something which stands in front of the kinetic energy-like term, but is tuned by how tightly you confine the particles. And it's not exactly a kinetic energy term. There's these rotation matrices which relate the bare states to the dress states that get in the way, and that leads to some kind of gauge potential. But that's standard whenever you have a position-dependent, or in this case, momentum-dependent redefinition of states. So anyhow, now one would now establish really the dual case to the position space double well. And we worked this out in ugly detail and basically gotten analytic results for all the terms in this expression. And one finds this term, there should be an L there, this term plus this term was the position space Hamiltonian that I'd written down that gives you all this interesting physics. One finds indeed that the interactions have the opposite sign in momentum space that they do in position space because of this exchange term, which causes different momentum classes to be disfavored. And then there's other subtleties, but these are also, I think, present in the double well and position space. There's a change in the difference in energies between the even and odd states due to interactions. That's pretty easy to understand. There's this sort of odd pair hopping term, but that's just because the right and left states are not strictly right and left. They're a little bit spilling over into the other wells. So I don't think this really leads to any extra complications beyond the model.
In the original double well, you also needed the excited state of each well to be higher in energy. So
it comes about with this mass parameter. And it's basically, this should have been the trap. So if you confine particles so tightly that it has to do with this mass parameter. If this sort of mass is small, then tunneling is weak, and weak with respect to the splittings between levels. So you'd be in this two-well model very nicely. There'll be regimes where you still can talk about confinement in the right and left states, but you're occupying many of the right and left states. That's a hard problem, which I don't think anybody's really dealt with in either of the cases. It's sort of a Gross-Piyevsky, but also many body. I don't think anybody has anything more than kind of a variational approach to that problem. And then there'll be the situation where, you know, your bound states are up here, and there's no point in talking about the double well anymore, and that you would have gotten by squeezing very hard on the atoms. So these are tunable.
You have to do this Kaufman-Thompson Fermi, right? You do this in the situation where you're going to
try. For this calculation to apply, you have to be out of the Thomas Fermi limit, which is ridiculous. Who wants to be out of the... I mean, when you have a million rubidium atoms, why do that? But it's just that I don't know how to theoretically handle the other one. There was an attempt to do it by Montina and Arecki in a PRA paper that they wrote, but it was just kind of an ad hoc approach that combined some results of Gross-Piyevsky and some results of a variational. I don't think it was... I still believe it's just an open... It's an open question to do it cleanly. You can do it in a messy manner using some variational wave function, but I don't think it's a good result. Anyhow, here are these splittings that you were talking about, and one needs to distinguish two different regimes. There's one strength of interactions where the distribution, so now let's say there's the probability to have a certain difference between the right and left wells, which is here at zero, and for a non-interacting condensate, this would just be Gaussian centered at zero. And as you turn up interactions, this is going to start splitting and eventually is going to become something which is very much showing you a Schrodinger cat state. So eventually you'll get a situation where all your atoms are in the right or all their atoms are in the left. In between, you'll have some tendency towards the Schrodinger cat state. And you can quantify these different regimes, just thinking of perturbation theory will do it, that there's one limit where the Schrodinger cats start to appear. And there's another limit where I can really think of the fact that I need all the particles in the right and not even one on the left. Okay. So if you insist on that far extreme limit of the real Schrodinger cat state, then indeed the difference, the splitting between the Schrodinger cat states, which is important if you want to establish that they're real, just drops like a rock as you increase the number of particles. So that is not going to be experimentally feasible. On the other hand, just asking to fulfill this criterion where you start going away from the non-correlated state is not a very difficult thing to ask. And so even for larger numbers of particles, you would get reasonable splittings between those levels. Yeah. The real test would be to see tunneling. Would you see macroscopic quantum tunneling?
But you do help.
Well, we'll see. I don't know how I do it. Maybe one does it by trying to use these things for a clock.
Yeah, I mean, I think actually this situation seems qualitatively rather similar to the sorts of things that people have done with squids in recent years.
Yes.
Of course, the way that you actually see that you, or you infer that you've got a Schrodinger's cat time at time t is not to look at time t, but to wait until the system has evolved. And
yes.
Then infer from that, and that's precisely what they do in those experiments.
Exactly. Yeah. So look at some time dependent evolution. That's absolutely right. So we've thought a little bit about how this might be useful, as other people have. If you had these many body states, how they might be useful, in particular for the measurement of time or for other interferometric measures of rotation or whatnot. And so let me just contrast the standard versus the non-standard type of atomic clock. The standard type of atomic clock uses a bunch of two-level atoms, all prepared in the same state, passes them through an interaction chamber where they acquire a pi over 2 pulse, which is generated by a clock. And you want this clock to beat at the same frequency as these atoms. The atoms, after having received this pi over 2 pulse, travel along freely from one interaction chamber to another. So there's a superposition between them, which is clocking at a certain rate. And there's also a clock, which is clocking at a certain rate. We're going to eventually compare these rates. They would pass through a second pi over 2 pulse. It would be favorable to have electronically added a pi over 2 phase delay to that second one. And that would ensure that when you now make a measurement, that you're most sensitive at the position where exactly the energy between the two levels matches the frequency of your clock. So you would run this experiment, and then based on what you got, let's say, for the population difference between levels A and B, you would either increase or decrease slightly the frequency of your clock and thereby keep it stabilized to the atomic transition. To see how good your clock is, you just need to think about what are you measuring and how much noise is there around the thing that you're measuring. And that would then give you a measure of how well you can determine the frequency difference, little delta, between the atomic frequency and the clock frequency. And one knows that this scales as 1 over the free evolution time, because you've looked at more cycles, so it's easier to tell a difference. And then also 1 over the square root of the number of particles because of a Poisson distribution. Doing this with many body states would be rather different, and it would be hard to do. That is, the difference between the conventional and the as yet unrealized unconventional atomic clock can be placed in a lot of positions in this Ramsey interferometer, but one place you might put it is in the pi over 2 pulse. Imagine that the pi over 2 pulse is quite a magic one, because it doesn't just take a single particle and do the same to each of the single particles. Rather, it rotates you in a two-state basis, the two states being all atoms in state A and all atoms in state B, and you simply apply a pi over 2 pulse in that state space. In that case, you would become a lot more sensitive given the number of atoms that you have in your system. That is, following one of these magic pi over 2 pulses, wherever you got it, and a second magic pi over 2 pulses, if you just do the same thing, you just measure atomic number in the A and B states down at the end, you would find that you have greatly increased your sensitivity. And the secret really lies in the fact that since all particles are either in the A or the B state, the difference in energies between them is n times the single particle energy. And that's what gives these Heisenberg limited clocks their extra power. And one can think of doing this with the with Schrodinger cat states, or there's other variants on the scheme as well. But what you would need is something like a magic pi over two pulse to implement such a scheme.
And the short line there, is it a short noise? And is it
yeah, so this would be the fluctuations. The fluctuations would be as big as related to the number of atoms, because when you're just at the most sensitive point, half the time all your atoms are in state A, and half the time all your atoms are in state B. So the fluctuations are as big as they can be. But even though there's these very big fluctuations in the relative number, you're measuring n times the frequency. And so when you balance the two against each other, you end up with actually a more stable clock. So every time you see all atoms in A, you turn your frequency one way. And every time you see all your atoms in B, you turn it the other way. And if you calibrate your hand to turn it the right amount, then you'll actually stay in a stable region, and you would actually measure frequency better and better over time. Yeah.
You're assuming that you have ideal perfect atom detectors at the
moment? Where we're going to be assuming it is not in this stage. This is not a problem, because the fluctuations are enormous, so you don't even have to measure very well. Application of our pi over two pulse, there's always something swept under the rug, and getting the pi over two pulse right is where the rug is.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
When you're dealing with one atom, you have a very well defined frequency between the transitions, so it's a standard of frequency that's
yeah.
where you fine-tune your clock.
Yeah.
But now, if you are dealing with a collective state, then your tunneling amplitude actually some macroscopic property. Doesn't it kill the whole idea?
So there's two things that kill the whole idea. Okay. One is this pi over two pulse. I'll show you how it's done, and the way it's done is awfully hard. Okay. So that will just kill it. Another thing you think what might kill it. Is the fact that you're measuring a frequency which is n times the regular frequency, but you don't know n. So what are you measuring? That's not really a problem. If you add this electronic pi over 2 phase shift over here, you can set up your clock to be stabilized at the point where the frequency is 0. And then fluctuations in n, they only change the slope around 0. So you'd be stabilizing to the right point regardless of the number of atoms. So there would be kind of you'd be in good shape. I mean, if you tried to measure one fringe away, you'd be in trouble, because that fringe would just be dancing all over the place with the number of particles you have. But the central fringe does cross 0 at the right spot.
I guess what Forrest, I think, was getting on was that the energy is not necessarily just n times the single particle energy. It's interactions as well.
Oh, well, then that's in every clock. So here's what we might be able to contribute to this problem. One is how we get this magic pi over two pulse. And the point is that we have something which we turn on and off, which is the Rabi frequency, which takes the system from one which does to one which doesn't have Schrodinger cat ground states. And so, for example, imagine we started with all of our atoms in the left well, and then we turned on our Raman beams. Now this left well is not a eigenstate of the system. The eigenstates are the even and odd combinations of the right and left well states. So the thing evolves. And if we can time the duration during which the Raman beams are on so that we get exactly a pi over two pulse, then we have exactly the result of this magic beam splitter. Now, you know, what's this so that I can get the pi over two pulse correctly? And that's where you'd really need to know the number. So we're looking a little bit at the question of, can you deal with the slightly Schrodinger cat squeezed states rather than the fully squeezed ones? It seems our original results show that you do get some benefits just applying a little bit of cattiness to these states, but one has to kind of work through it. Another thing which is really nice about this system is the following. Let's say we're actually generating these Schrodinger cat states. These are very strange cats. They're running in two directions at once. And it's hard to think of where we would use this for the measurement of something with precision. But one thing which we think we can also do in such a system is map these Schrodinger cat states onto things that are useful. So for example, if I take the Rabi frequency and I adiabatically, with respect to tunneling, say, adiabatically switch it to 0, then all the atoms over here, which were B stationary plus a little bit of A moving, just get converted into B stationary. And then likewise here. So now we end up with a Schrodinger cat superposition in a state which is ideal for the measurement of time. On the other hand, if we change the detuning, let's say we sweep the detuning to plus or minus infinity, one can convert these Schrodinger cat states adiabatically into superpositions of different external states. So now you've produced a Schrodinger cat state which is appropriate for interferometry. And you can do this within your generation of magic pi over two pulses. So I got to one topic, and it's 1 o'clock. Should I just stop? I could run through our present experiment and then stop. Okay. Just throw things at me. Okay, so here's real experiment. Yeah. We're thinking about nonlinear optics and how it might relate to Bose condensates. Nonlinear optics, from a simpleton's perspective, such as mine, can be thought of as a competition between two processes. One is that a system, once exposed to light, tries to relax back to its initial state. And so then the second photon that encounters the system sees the same system. However, these photons are also trying to maybe change the system, pump it into some sort of ordering, which will alter the state for the second photon coming in. And so if you can pump more order into the system than it can get rid of, then nonlinear optics will ensue, because more intensity you have, the more change the system will be for the later photons that arrive. And this can be identified in a number of different nonlinear optical processes where you have a balance between some kind of dissipative mechanism and some sort of ordering in the system. Now, how might this be different in a system such as a condensate in which there's long-range coherence and something like Bose stimulation? What the difference that we're trying to get at is the fact that pumping need not be a single particle event, but it can be a collective event. That is, for example, something like optical pumping, you can certainly think of the fact that it could be a Bose-enhanced rather than a single particle process. And so rather than getting a gradual transition from linear to nonlinear optics, you might expect that because Bose stimulation has an exponential behavior, that at some point a collective pumping will kick in and suddenly switch your system from being in a linear to a nonlinear regime. And I'll show you in a sec that one thing that's appealing to us about this in particular is that it appears that the nonlinear optical response is just very strongly linked to the presence of a phase transition. And so what appeals to us about this is that, you know, long-range phase coherence or long-range ordering of Bose condensate, what are its consequences? And there are some consequences which are very artificial, such as if I do an interference experiment, I get stable fringes. That's not something you typically do with a cup of water. But you do shine light at a cup of water. So if we can find that optical properties are similarly influenced by long-range coherence, then there's an interesting connection to pedestrian properties of a material. This field has started. So the experiments on super radiance, which were done in the Ketterly group and also since then in other groups, are sort of getting at this this perspective on nonlinear optics. Although they, at this point, just look like particular instances rather than pointing at a general theme. In that case, you have just scattering off of a two-level atom. And if staring at the density matrix, you can imagine that there's the light is trying to create a larger coherence between the ground and excited states. And spontaneous emission is trying to get rid of that coherence. In the case of Bose condensates, what one finds is that there's a predilection towards super radiance, where what happens is that photons impinging on the system, after they've scattered, they leave behind not just a condensate, but a copy of the condensate, which is recoiling at some velocity. And so long as that copy of the condensate overlaps the original condensate, it provides population in the final state for scattering, and therefore can Bose enhance more photons to pop off in the same direction. And this can be seen quite strikingly in momentum space, where as you turn up intensity, you start, rather than building up just a halo of scattered particles, you build up a lot of order in momentum space, where you see super radiant emission both of atoms and light in particular directions influenced by the geometry of the system. So the threshold for super radiance has within it evidence of the phase transition. So thinking about the superradiant process, you can think that the rate of change of the number of recoiling atoms in a particular mode is given as follows. There's a gain term which multiplies 1, that means it just spontaneously atoms fall into that mode, but also multiplies the number of atoms. This is the Bose enhancement factor. And if this thing is allowed to build up, you can get exponential super radiance in the system. That competes against a loss term. The loss term here is simply Doppler broadening, just like it is in any super radiance experiment. But one view of Doppler broadening is that it's basically the time at which that it takes for an atom which is recoiling at the recoil velocity to travel one coherence length. So if you're measuring threshold, which is basically varying the power of this until it overcomes the loss rate, you're measuring coherence length. And so the threshold intensity versus temperature would have the following dependence. For thermal clouds, the threshold for a super radiance might be rather high, because it's determined by 1 over this de Broglie wavelength, which is a pretty large quantity and depends on the temperature. And then in a large box, when the thing Bose condenses, the coherence length has nothing to do with the temperature anymore. It suddenly drops to be the, or it suddenly rises up and diverges to the size of the box. So the intensity would undergo evidence of a phase transition. There'd be a sudden kink to where it would take basically zero power to induce super radiance in a condensate because it has long-range coherence. And so let's start looking at this kind of behavior for other types of nonlinear optical processes as well. In a finite system where the size of the condensate increases gradually as you add atoms to the condensate, then you might get this smoothed out behavior. But as always, when you have a finite system, the evidence of a phase transition is not so striking. Yeah?
Now, would one also expect something smoothed out on the other side due to sort of
Dickey narrowing? Oh.
As you approach the condensation point, there's something's happening other than with no length scale entering the system.
It's just a threshold, it's not a signal. So fluctuations are not present. Once you have long range shorter, you do not have a threshold any longer.
Let's think about it.
So, I
mean, this appeals to me because it's interesting to be able to measure coherence length versus just condensate density. And there's a lot of experiments where we could think that that would be interesting. And this thing really takes a sharp dip. That is, when we did these experiments, we found that even the slightest little condensates would super radiate. It was really striking, whereas just a high density core doesn't give you long range coherence. And you can't see just by taking a picture that there's actually coherence in a high density core. You have to do something else. This directly gets at the phase, at the long-range coherence, so it's an appealing experiment.
When you have the phase transition, if you can, if you're able to go close to TC, this would be, I assume, sensitive to density fluctuations, right?
Yes.
Can you see anything, or will mean you clear just to pick up?
I don't know. I would imagine an experimentalist hardly knows when TC is happening. I just don't think we have the precision in our experiments to look that close. Okay, we're thinking of applying this to a different magneto-optical or a different nonlinear process, which is nonlinear magneto-optic rotation. So here's how you would measure such a thing. You'd send polarized light through a cell of atoms which are living in a magnetic field, and the light may be rotated, for example, due to the linear Faraday effect, if there's an energy splitting between the levels. But there's also a nonlinear Faraday effect which occurs. And this can be thought of as follows. When you have a lot of light that's impingent on a vapor, be it thermal or condensed, what it might do is pump all the atoms into a dark state. That is one for which just light propagating along a particular direction will pass through the system without any absorption. If there's a magnetic field around, though, then this axis of clarity can be rotated. And there'll be a balance between the rotation of this clear axis and its restoration by optical pumping. Now you end up having light going through a system which is like a rotated polarizer, and therefore the light will rotate as it exits. We're thinking about doing this not really in a static situation, but a time-dependent situation. So think about just the example I talked to you about, where you start with atoms which are in this clear, are in the dark state. They've been pumped into this transparent state. So first, there would be no rotation on your light because it's passing through a rotator that's not polarized. Now, if the atoms live in the presence of a magnetic field, this rotator will rotate. This polarizer will rotate slowly, and the rotation angle will increase linearly according to Larmor precession. And then over time, optical pumping will send it, will send the system towards equilibrium, and the rotation angle will reach some plateau. And if the magnetic field is strong, the plateau will be higher because you can accomplish more rotation within an optical pumping time. In a condensate, we're looking for the following signal, which would be quite different. That is, under similar circumstances, if you have your atoms in the optically pumped state, they're transparent and there's no scattering, there's no discussion of superradiance. And now the magnetic field would come along and it would rotate your atoms from a dark state into a bright state. And once that bright state hits this critical point at which it goes superradiant, it should exponentially relax itself back down. If optical pumping is what's favored by superradiance, it would exponentially ramp itself back down to zero rotation angle. This thing could recur if you had multiple cycles of superradiance, which is actually seen in the Rayleigh scattering situation. So we're looking for a signal like this, where there would be an angle beyond which the condensate does not want to rotate, because it exponentially restores itself once it gets there. Where we've gotten so far is basically to be testing superradiance at various rotation angles, but nothing dynamic at this point. So there's a little bit of atomic physics that goes into this, which one can do. That it's a light scattering problem. You need to know what polarization of light you're sending in, what's the starting point for your condensate. There's different output directions from the system, but you're interested in particular about how you, what kind of light will come out the end fire modes of the condensates. Those are the ones that will be geometrically favored. And we have a formalism which will give us an understanding of which type of light, of the different polarizations of light that can come out the end fire mode, which is favored, and then which atomic state should be output as a result of emitting that kind of light. And the result is that what should be produced in superradiance is sometimes the bright state, sometimes the dark state. Very often it's a superposition of different sublevels. So there's a lot of interesting and maybe puzzling behavior that we're going to be looking forward to seeing, which we've been seeing. We have condensates. Took a little while to build one, but we have kind of a MIT-style rubidium BEC machine, which produces condensates of a couple of million atoms, and probably will be tweaked up to maybe 10 million at some stage when we have the time. And so we've been implementing this in the lab, as I said, we do this in time of flight. And what that allows us to do is to orient the internal state of the condensate to an arbitrary direction. The condensate is spin polarized, but if we just rotate the magnetic field slowly, it'll follow that magnetic field. So we can explore superradiance where we have some control over the initial state of the condensates, a lot of control over the polarization of light, and no control over the orientation of the condensate, but given that you can rotate the other things, we're in good shape. And we're playing with superradiance primarily between the 1 to 0 transition in rubidium. That's because atoms will fluoresce out of here and return down to the F equals 1 level, which kind of satisfies our search for optical pumping to something relevant. Anyhow, I think I'll skip most of this just to say that the idea sort of makes sense, what we've been looking for. That is, when you have this polarization of light going through the system near the 1 to 0 transition, it turns out that atoms which are spin polarized along this direction will not absorb the light, because this is pi polarized light and these are m equals minus 1 atoms. Okay, so in that case, light goes through the system and there's no superradiance. There's very little scattering. There's not much of anything. And now as you rotate this magnetic field, you rotate your atoms out of the dark state into the bright state, and superradiance turns on, kind of in the sense that we would be looking for. So we need to find some kind of threshold behavior in this that we're currently gearing up to find. One thing that's puzzling to us is that in a lot of instances, a lot of the geometries would have preferred a type of atomic output which is not strictly in one of the Zeeman sublevels, but often in a mixture of various sublevels. And we've never been able to see conclusive evidence of a system which prefers to superradiate into multiple Zeeman sublevels at once rather than just one. It's not really clear to us what these superpositions do when they're now living in a magnetic field, whether there's some effect on superradiance with regard to Larmor precession, but anyhow, it's maybe more of an atomic physics puzzle at this stage. So maybe I will just stop here so I can field questions.
Thank you very much, Dan. Further questions or comments?
I have a question. I would like to return to Eric's remark. Apparently, I didn't understand it at once. So the remark was, as far as I said, when you approach the critical point, you see a divergent correlation line, because what appears in the system is a sort of fluctuation kindness. So my question is whether you can resolve this interesting feedback, so resolve the criticality of the appearance of condensate. Because when condensate appears, actually you have a fluctuation region. When the condensate is not a homogeneous, stable, stationary solution of Gauss-Peters, it's a dynamical classical field. So instead of this jump on your plot at PC, you're supposed to see something like an indication of diverging correlation.
Yeah.
So the question is it possible to resolve this with your technique?
If you could control the initial conditions, if I could have a system where I've really parked it right near TC or within epsilon of TC, then yes, I think you would be able to shine light in, look for evidence of superradiance, either by the fact that it's scattering light in a certain direction or atoms are scattered in a certain direction, either way. And you would find shot to shot that there's fluctuations in that because you're probing the system at a given period of time, which is maybe shorter than the dynamics of long coherence length sections being created and destroyed. So I think you would be able to see fluctuations. Now, divergence.
Not about the fluctuations from shot to shot, but just from about the position of the threshold. Because if you have a kind of turbulent system, your threshold will be essentially lower. It will not be zero as in the case of pure condensate.
No, yeah, I think
it will
the way
be
you
essentially lower than in the case of normal gas. And this function, the position of the threshold is a function of vicinity to the critical point.
Just
give the information about the correlation radius.
Yeah.
Actually, you can measure criticality.
I think the way you would do this is you would shine in superradiant light, which is being ramped up in power, and use a time-sensitive photodetector to collect the light that may be emitted by superradiance, and just see when does that spike occur. Does it occur at early times, which meant low superradiance intensity, low light intensities occur at later times, which meant higher? Does it occur at multiple times because different pieces of your sample are superradiating at different times because of different coherence lengths? I think you'd look for something like that. Now, this would be of limited use. It's probably a rather destructive probe, but anyhow, it'd be something worth seeing because it just marks a real clear distinction for when the condensate shows up, which is otherwise it just looks like a little bit of a darker speck in your imaging, and that's not really a very clear signature, which only gets a density and something about energetics, but not really about phase coherence.
You want to finish it?
No.
Okay, so I have a question about this magic pile of tuples.
Yeah.
If I start with double wire system, and assume I have a trapped interaction, double wire in the real space, or double wire in P space, they have double positive interaction to start with. To have this magic pulse, right, I guess I have to work in the limit where the energy cost to add additional particle into one of the state, that energy cost has to be a lot higher than the one particle time.
Yes.
That's the limit. You have magic cost, right? In the opposite limit, you will have the usual pile of two parts.
Yeah.
If that's the case, then that also means the splitting or the time dependence is basically limited by interaction. So.
Yeah.
That's the.
Yes. No, it's right. And that was, I mean, I showed this one slide about the splitting between the Schrodinger cat states, which drops exponentially with the number, because you need to tune the system, you know, to lower and lower tunneling rates to get this to work, essentially, right? So, and also, yeah, so anyway, end particle tunneling just becomes really unlikely, and so the splitting drops off. And so what use is that? So that's why we've been looking at whether the partly catty states still give you an improvement over the standard quantum limit for interferometry. So something, a result we're trying to work on is double well position momentum space, doesn't matter. Give me N, U, and J, and I'll give you how much your interferometer is better. And that, I think, is a good, it's a real criterion for quantifying these correlations, and I think it would be a useful result to have. Now, one might also worry about the fact that this, you know, the way I portrayed this magic pi over 2 pulse is with respect to the real Schrodinger cat state, where you start with all the atoms in the left, and then they all tunnel back and forth to the right well. And, you know, that's in this bad limit, right? So I think the way you would do this is you would skip this initial stage, and you would just cool your system so that it started in this state. That would be the first pi over 2 pulse. It would just be, the initial state would be what had been produced by your first pi over 2 pulse, or essentially, right? Then turning the Raman coupling off, maybe there's an energy difference between the levels which can now accrue. And then I think applying the second pi over 2 pulse would do the right thing. It would take you from a certain superposition of, you know, these aren't strictly right and left, these are sort of right and sort of left states, but I think you'd get the right superposition. You start in the right basis. Or not. And, you know, this all depends on knowing this. I mean, you really want to know this number. One thing about our scheme, which is very handy, is that because you can place the atoms into different internal states, not that you can count the total number, of course, but you can also, in between, you can start counting the number in each of the wells. And I think in a real position space double well, that would be a pretty hard thing to do. You've got things spaced, separated by a fraction of a micron. How are you going to do this kind of imaging? But if you put them into different internal states, you can just measure one and then go and measure the other, and you have all the time in the world to do so. So this might be something that we implement in our cavity experiment, where we should have very high sensitivity to the number of atoms and be able to measure one by one up to 100 or a few hundred. So.
You need certain kind of Mach physics to get this kind of state.
Some kind of Mott physics. You need interactions, you need tunneling, in that sense. Yeah. Well, yes, well, I don't think that's an issue. It's all, I mean, again, you're tuning the mass with tuning the trap. This, I think it's all scalable.
So if you compare the sensitivity of your Schrodinger cat clocks with clocks, based on the squeeze states, I mean,
do you
the same gain?
It's the same gain. It seems a little weird. It's the same gain even though the result is fluctuating all over the place.
Yeah.
It still works out. It actually still works out. That there's sort of the one that Kasevich had imagined, where rather than a magic pi over 2 pulse, you have a magic detector, which can tell when the difference between the atom numbers is 0 or 1 or even or odd or whatever. Anyhow, there's magic somewhere in the scheme. They all kind of yield the same precision.
And even in your heart, if you forget that the Schrodinger cats are babies, I mean, which scheme will survive? The squeeze states or cats? The clocks?
I don't think it makes a difference.
Equally hard.
They're equally hard, yeah. Okay. I mean, you know this paper by Dowling where he says, you know, there's magic somewhere, and you know, Jonathan Dowling has this very amusing paper about the similarity between, I mean, there's so many papers written about this that somebody had to just write down a paper which says, look, all your papers are exactly the same, and like, just stop the flow. I don't think it worked, but it was a pretty amusing paper in which he described a quantum Rosetta Stone which connects various diagrams of various communities to the same concept. Anyhow, it was very amusing, but what I picked out of it is that there's magic somewhere, and in the various schemes, you can look at one of the elements and say, that's ridiculous. So here, you know, that's ridiculous. But the other things are pretty reasonable.
Yes.
So, yeah.
So in your Raman model, you completely neglect spontaneous loss?
Yeah.
Spontaneous emission, right?
Yeah, at this stage.
And if you were to add those, how would it affect your cats?
Oh, the cats would probably be toast. You just need to work. It depends. You know, if you're talking about the right Raman transition, you can go very far off resonance, right? The one we'd want to work with is rubidium in the two levels that have the same magnetic moment. That's a delta M equals 2 transition. That's not a great idea because you can't tune very far off resonance. The Raman coupling strength goes with the same scaling as the spontaneous emission rate. But different transitions, you can...
Both lasers talk to the same transition, not just the one that you fixed.
But you have polarization. Yeah, that's true. But that's...
losses inevitably.
No, because you can detune from the common... You can change the detuning from the excited state. The spontaneous emission rates will drop as 1 over delta squared. Versus the Raman coupling rate, which will go like 1 over delta. So you can control that.
The numbers, what would you get? Milliseconds, microseconds, or
I mean, look, we can put together optical traps that have depths of microkelvin and scattering lifetimes of seconds or tens of seconds. The same applies to the Raman coupling strength. So you can make it really quite impressive if you needed to. And then next, you know, if you're not insisting on this extreme cat, but the sort of cat, it's not as susceptible to loss. You know, if you see, oh, I had a particle in the right, but not all your particles were in the right to begin with, you haven't lost as much information, so.
Okay, maybe this is a good point to stop the formal proceedings and thank Dan once again.
Sure.
Before you go,